we resume our deliberations, Bishah Tova, with the Parsha of Shoftim. It's a Parsha that deals with many major institutions within Torah. It begins with the Sanhedrin, Shoftim and Shotrim, moving on to Melech, to the king, then discussing Kohanim and Levim, moving on from there to Navi, culminating in conduct during war. These are very weighty discussions, and Mirtz Hashem will take a look at a couple of them this evening. The opening of the Parsha, which is it deals with Shoftim, the Sanhedrin, the authority of the Sanhedrin, and the Torah issues a directive with regards to heeding that authority, and that's to be found in Perek Yud Zayin, Pasuk Yud Aleph. And there, the Torah states, Al Pia Torah, again, Perek Yud Zayin, Pasuk Yud Aleph, Al Pia Torah, Sheyerucha, based on the Torah that they instruct you, Bala Mishpat HaShiyomu Lecha, the ruling that they tell you, Ta'aseh, so you shall do, Lo Sasur Min HaDavar, Asheyagidu Lecha, Yamin Usma, shall not swerve or depart from the words of the Sanhedrin, not to the right and not to the left. There is a major discussion amongst Rishonim, which we're not going to go into this evening, we've dealt with on the previous occasions, as to which shilas or which scope of matters are covered by the Torah's directive to heed the Sanhedrin. Is it specifically their rulings and interpretations vis-a-vis Torah law? Does it even include rabbinic law, as is the opinion of, as is well known of the Rambam? But be that as it may, to whatever the Torah is referring, the instruction is quite clear, not to swerve, not to the right, and not to the left. And there is a well-known statement of Chazal with regards to right and left, which is quoted by Rashi. The source is in the Sifrei, the Medrash Halacha on this Parsha. Yaminu Smol, Rashi comments, Afilu Omer Lecha al Yaminshu Smol, Bal Smol Shel Hu Yamin. When the Torah says not to swerve from the Sanhedrin, in terms of what they say, right or left, that means even if they say about right that it's left, and left that it's right, as if to say right, left, doesn't make a difference. Sanhedrin has spoken, and that's that. Rashi actually adds something which is not in the Sifrei. It's a nice P.S. V'kol sheken she'omer lecha al yamin yamin v'al smol smol. And certainly if they tell you that right is right and left is left, I mean, that's should certainly be understood. Okay. Now, interestingly, before we get into the discussion, and it warrants discussion, this idea of right and left, smol she'omer yamin, yamin she'omer smol, but we start, of course, with the parshanut of the matter. After all, it's fair to say that one could argue that the simple reading of the pasuk of Yaminu Smol is qualifying not to depart from them to the right or to the left. It's about you departing. Don't depart to the right. And if that's true, then it has nothing to do with what they say, whether right is left. It's about where you go. Don't go to the right or don't go to the left. Interestingly, Rashi did not understand it that way. And the reason why, as Mefarshim point out, I saw in the Sefer Shari Aharon, is that if these words, Yaminu Smol, were coming to qualify how you shouldn't depart to the right or to the left, so they should have immediately followed the words, Lo Tasur. If we look again at the Pasuk, it says, Lo Tasur, do not swerve, Min HaDavar She'agidu Lecha, from the words that they say to you, Yaminu Smol. So actually, the words Yaminu Smol could better have been placed straight after Lo Tasur, in which case it would have said, Lo Tasur Yaminu Smol, do not depart to the right or to the left from that which they tell you. However, because the Torah delayed the insertion of these words Yaminu Smol and placed them not immediately after you not departing, but rather placed them straight after what the Sanhedrin says, that's why Rashi explains that Yaminu Smol actually qualify the second phrase, Asheyagidu Lecha Yaminu Smol. But what does it mean? They tell you right and left. Enter the Sifrei, right is left, left is right. So that's in terms of the Parshanut. We always keep an eye out for not only what Chazal said, but what did Rashi see fit to bring into his Perush, which is reactive and responsive to matters of Pshuta Shel Mikra. Now, Still, before we come to consider the idea of right and left, what does it mean? It's important, I would say, in the interests of broader disclosure, to be aware that as much as we're familiar with this saying, even if they say right is left and left is right, and that's what Chazal have to say on the matter, it happens to be that there's another statement of Chazal about this pasuk, and it seems to say exactly the opposite. That is to be found in the Yerushalmi, in Maseches Horios, in Perek Aleph. And there the Yerushalmi states, and now we need to access both sides of the brain, one for the Sifrei and one for the Yerushalmi. Sifrei, we've seen, right is left and left is right. And now the Yerushalmi says, Yachol, I might have thought, Im yomru lecha al yamin shehu smol, bal smol shehu yamin, tishma lehem. I might think that even if they tell you that right is left and left is right, that you should listen. Talmud Lomar, to that end, the Torah says, yamin u'smol, it's got to be right and left. Ad sheyomru lecha al yamin shehu yamin, bal smol shehu smol. It's got to be that they're saying that right is right and left is left, not the other way around. So now, I think it's fair to say we've lost pretty much all sense of direction. Because the Sifrei tells us that we need to follow the Sanhedrin, one could almost say blind, whether they say right is left, left is right. Along comes the Yerushalmi and says, not at all. They say right and left. Well, you need to listen to them. No, only when they say right is right, left is left. So how are we, if we can, and there are Mefarshim who maintain that we can, how do we make a shalom between these two Perushim, between these two statements of Chazal? The Ramban, in his Hasagos, in his critical commentary to the Rambam Sefer HaMitzvot, he doesn't mention the Yerushalmi explicitly, but through his words we can arrive at a harmonization, a resolution. When do we say we do follow the Sanhedrin, even if right is left, and when do we say only when right is right and left is left? So Ramban has a certain stipulation, a certain proviso with regards to this directive to follow the Sanhedrin. And that is, says Ramban, imagine you have a posek, you have a halachic authority. He hears that the Sanhedrin has just permitted something that, as far as he's concerned, it cannot be permitted. That's the news for today. So what's he to do, and what's he to make of this? Well, says Ramban, he is not licensed immediately on their leniency, because after all, he has his misgivings. He has his counter-arguments. He has his contrary position. What should he do? Says Ramban, you know what he should do? He should write a letter. Or better still, take a trip to the Sanhedrin and present his case. If he really feels that there's something he could say that could lead the Sanhedrin to reconsider the matter, he has a responsibility, not only to himself, but also to others, to say so. And pending having presented his counter-argument, he is not licensed to rely on that leniency. As far as he's concerned, it's a mistake. However, says Ramban, that's stage one. But once he's performed his due diligence and he's been in contact with the Sanhedrin, presented his counter-argument, they've heard it and considered it and nonetheless rejected it and maintain their original stance, from that point onward, says Ramban, his conscience is clear. You've said your piece, you've said what needs to be said, they've heard you and we're still not swayed for whatever reason. At this point, you can't say, if they knew what I know, they would have ruled differently. No, they know what you know and still they rule the same. At that point, we say that even if you consider it to be right, but they say left or vice versa, at that point you follow the Sanhedrin. And therefore, with this proviso of Ramban, we can find a way to harmonize the two statements of Chazal. When Chazal told us at the outset, that is to say the Yerushalmi, which states that not to rely on the Sanhedrin, if they say right is left and left is right, that's initially. If you see it as left and you have not yet been in contact with them to state your case, you cannot rely on a leniency. However, once you've been in contact and you've been in dialogue and they've heard you and nonetheless rule as they do, at that point the second statement, which we saw first, the Sifrei, kicks in, and even if it's right or left, you follow what the Sanhedrin says. So that's one classic reconciliation of the two statements of Chazal. But if we proceed along our course of examining the Sifrei and ask a Balabatisha question, why should one follow the Sanhedrin if they say that right is left and left is right? It sounds like they've said something which is incorrect. What is behind following the Sanhedrin in a situation like this? And really, the approaches of the classic Mefarshim to this question, one could say, are divided into two. As if to say, the underlying question is, are we to understand that the Torah is dealing with a case where the Sanhedrin are actually in error? Or perhaps you may think they're in error. For some people, those two are synonymous. If I think they're in error, they are. There is no possibility of me thinking something and it not being true. Well, sometimes there is. And that then divides the two schools among the Mefarshim as to how to understand what the Sifrei is saying. If we begin with the Ramban, and that's the Ramban in his Perush on the Torah here, Ramban said, by definition, these sorts of cases where you're in debate and you have a contrary opinion to the Sanhedrin, they're not going to be things that are black and white in the Pasuk. I mean, that's not even called a ruling. That's called reading. If the Sanhedrin says that you can perform malacha on Shabbos and the Torah says you can't, that's not between you and the Sanhedrin. That's between God and the Sanhedrin. But that's not the type of thing we're talking about. By definition, we're talking about matters that are subject to interpretation and different points of view. And it's quite clear to you that your point of view is correct, and you're entitled to your point of view. But when it comes to a clash, and what seems very clear to you to be right, the Sanhedrin says is left, and vice versa, the Torah says follow the Sanhedrin. And what's behind this? What's behind it is, says Ramban, you need to consider that the Sanhedrin, for a variety of reasons, or for a number of reasons, are actually in the right, and you're in the wrong, as amazing as that sounds, as inconceivable as it sounds, who is in error. And the reason why, says Ramban, is number one, the Sanhedrin has a special siyata d'shmaya, they have a special divine assistance because they are basically the authority for the entire Jewish people. That added responsibility gives them added assistance. In addition, they are located on the Beis HaMikdash, which is right near where the Shechina is. For all of these reasons, if it's between you and them, as hard as it is for you to make room for someone else's point of view, if one of you has to budge, it should be you in terms of who is correct. And therefore, says Ramban, what the Sifrei is saying, in interpretation of this pasuk, is that something is very clearly, in your estimation, right, but they say it's left. You need to be prepared to change your mind. For some people, that's the greatest upheaval of all. However, there are other Mefarshim who seem to take the second approach, that is to say, perhaps it really is true that the Sanhedrin are in error, and still the Torah says to follow them. When you say that it's right and they say left, it really is right. And they say left, and they shouldn't have said that it's left, but they do, and still the Torah says to follow them. But why? And here there are also two variations one could say. The Gur Aryeh, the Maharal, the Perush Gur Aryeh, explains that it can happen sometimes that there are, shall we say, local concerns and there are global concerns. As if to say, each and every halachic situation has its psak, has its correct and incorrect ruling. But then there is the general idea of the Jewish people following the Sanhedrin. That is such an overwhelmingly important idea that in principle the Jewish people are behind the Sanhedrin, especially as when you consider that the times when the Sanhedrin, even if it could happen, and perhaps it could happen, no one is infallible, but statistically and in terms of likelihood, these are the keenest minds, the most scholarly minds of the Jewish people, and therefore all things being equal, how many times, even if they could make a mistake, how many times will they make a mistake? It's not the norm. It's clearly an exception to the rule. Following the rule of following the Sanhedrin is so important for the Jewish people as a whole that it overrides even following what might even be an incorrect ruling once in a long while. That's the interpretation of Maharal. So in other words, we have a concern that goes beyond the specific case at hand. It's called following the Sanhedrin. Because if the alternative was true and there was disruption and fragmentation and each person passes the way he does, the good news is that the maximum gain is that he may get the halacha right here. The loss is a complete breakdown in terms of the Jewish people in the Sanhedrin. It's not worth it. As surely one could almost say, as there are certain other considerations that override local halachic questions. Pikuach nefesh, for example, this is pikuach nefesh. The Jewish people and their relationship to the Sanhedrin is pikuach nefesh. So it's very interesting because we, I think, are not familiar with the idea of there being one central body that the entire Jewish people, and there were more than one Sanhedrin at the time, but there is the Sanhedria Gedola, and they are the final word, and what they say for the Jewish people is the situation for the Jewish people. We don't have that. And because we, in the absence of that, we do what is correct, and that is, Aseh lecha rav, each person follows their rav, and therefore we don't properly can't even dream in our current state of having one body which would then paskun for everyone. And moreover, there is room for different psakim, ve'elu divrei Elokim Chaim, etc. and so forth. But nonetheless, for matters that reach the Sanhedrin Gedola, the Supreme Sanhedrin, it is important for all of Jewish people to be aligned with that, and it could override even what might be a mistake. That is the very profound nation of the Maharal in the Gur Aryeh. Interestingly, and a slightly different, as we said, variation of this idea comes again from the Ramban. The Ramban, he, although it's one paragraph, he actually splits up into two approaches. For we need to consider, and again, also a major idea, but we need to consider what it means when we say the Sanhedrin made a mistake. After all, if the halacha under debate by definition is a matter of interpretation, so what you're saying is the absolute truth is with me, and the Sanhedrin in this case are offside that absolute truth, and therefore they are in error. And I need to be convinced as to why I should follow them. However, says Ramban, it could be that halacha doesn't really work that way. As if to say, it could be that in entrusting the Sanhedrin with the ruling of the halacha and following the majority, etc. and so forth, that itself is the definition of what the halacha is. As if to say, of all the acceptable ways of understanding, as long as they are authentic and true to Torah principles, there may be more than one way to apply them, and perhaps the different applications will give conflicting rulings. Nonetheless, as long as they are based on Torah true principles, it could be that with this, the Torah is actually defining the halacha, which is quite a radical idea. And this brings us to the famous episode, which we consult every once in a while, of the Tanur of Ben Achnai, the snake oven, where you had Rabbi Eliezer, and he felt that this oven, it's a very complicated oven, it's a whole shaila, can it receive tumah, can it not receive tumah? The person who made this oven clearly had no idea what he was precipitating here, but it could be they were at a premium beyond that point. But initially the shaila is, can it be mekabel tumah? Rabbi Eliezer says no, under no circumstances. The Chachamim said yes. And you have Rabbi Eliezer, he's fencing single-handedly with all of the Chachamim, it's a Gemara in Bar Metzia and Daf Nun Tes. And in the end, he calls in for what one can only refer to as aerial support, whereby Rabbi Eliezer says, if I'm correct, so let the Shemaim should prove that I'm correct, and he ultimately asks for a baskal. He asks for a voice from heaven to back him up. And a voice comes out that Rabbi Eliezer is right. And Rabbi Yeshua at that point makes his famous pronouncement, Lo b'shamayim hi, Torah is not in heaven, it's here. And the question there is why is that correct? And it is. You have the famous PS of that story where Eliyahu HaNavi finds, so to speak, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, who's smiling at this whole episode and says, Nitzchuni banai, Nitzchuni banai, they've overpowered me, my sons. And many Mefarshim explained that that's how halacha is meant to work. As if to say that HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, as long as it's based on Torah true principles, whatever you decide, it needs to be the way that the Sanhedrin decides, and that has the endorsement, which means we're no longer looking for the absolute answer, but you're looking for the as close as you can get to what the correct answer is. Sanhedrin will tend to get it, but whatever the Sanhedrin decides is the halacha. And indeed, that's what allows for the perpetuation of halacha. Some Mefarshim explained that when Hashem says Nitzchuni Banai, it's not from the word Nitzachon, but from the word Netzach. Not an expression of victory, but an expression of permanence, as if to say Nitzchuni Banai, through this, the Sanhedrin will always be followed, and that's correct. And therefore, according to the Ramban, This really is what's being intimated by the Torah saying, "Follow the Sanhedrin, whether they say right is left and left is right." One doesn't wish to say that it doesn't matter because they need to do their utmost to arrive at the correct conclusion. But whatever the conclusion is, you need to follow it because, by definition, that's what the halacha is. Interestingly, these two approaches, and again, if we may summarize, the two approaches either follow right, if they say right is left, you need to follow them because maybe you think it's right, but in reality it's left. And approach two, which is if they say right is left, you need to follow them because even if it isn't, follow them for reasons that we discussed. It's possible that these two approaches are reflected in two readings of the Sifrei itself. Our reading, which we have from Rashi, is afilu omer lecha ayamin shu smol, al smol shu yamin. Even if he says about left that it's right and right is left, which seems to indicate that it isn't really left, it's really right, but he says that it's left. But there is another reading of the Sifrei, which I think is the reading of the Vilna Gaon, and that is afilu nirim be'einecha al smol shu yamin. Even that it appears to you that they said about right that it's left and left is right, nonetheless to follow them. And that seems to be more in line with the first approach, that you may think it's one way, perhaps you should reconsider that it's not that way. If it's you versus the Sanhedrin, you're you, they're the Sanhedrin, and their point of view is actually the more correct one. That's the breakthrough. The final approach that I would like to offer, and there are a number of them, it's a big discussion, is from the Abarbanel. And he has quite a novel way of looking at this statement of the Sifrei. And in so doing, he'll introduce us to an important idea, which I'm not sure that we often focus on. As far as we know, the job of the Sanhedrin is to paskan halacha, and whatever it is, and they rule accordingly, and act accordingly, shoftim v'shoftrim. However, says Abarbanel, there is another type of law that is entrusted to the Sanhedrin. The Gemara speaks about this in Sanhedrin. And the Gemara says that sometimes it is important or necessary for the Sanhedrin to issue a ruling which is not the strict halachic ruling for that case, but required in that case, because they kind of have an eye on, again, more broader concerns. In the words of the Gemara, Bezdin makin v'onshin shalo apitin Torah. They can issue punishment even if it's not strict in Torah. If they see that something has been breached so severely, and if they don't do anything because the halacha doesn't exactly add up to an incrimination, or and then things will just completely unravel. Sometimes there is something called a contingency ruling, and that's also important. So it's like a emergency session, emergency situation. And in fact, the Gemara gives an example. There was a time, certainly, I think it was around the time of the Greek exile, and things were, again, going to pieces a little bit. There was a person who brazenly, he rode a horse through Jerusalem on Shabbos. Now, riding a horse is not a Torah prohibition on Shabbos. It's actually a rabbinic prohibition. You may come to take up a branch from a tree to use as a crop. That's a decree, preventative decree. And he was put to death by the Sanhedrin, says the Gemara. And the reason why is because it was such a high-profile act, and the implications of remaining inactive, it's basically the end of Shabbos. And therefore, the Sanhedrin ruled. And moreover, says Abarbanel, that is what they need to do. And if they don't do that, but only follow the normal rules, always, that could be a dereliction of duty. Ad kedei kach. And with this in mind, says Abarbanel, he explains the statement of the Gemara in Shabbos, Daf Kuf Yod Ches, which says, these are the words of the Gemara, Lo Charva Yerushalayim. The reason why Jerusalem was destroyed is Al She'emidu Dinehem Al Din Torah, because people established a ruling based on Torah. Now, that's a shocking statement. After all, establishing a ruling on Din Torah, it sounds like a good thing. It sounds like the type of thing that we promote in our religion, which is Torah. What then does the Gemara mean when it says that was the Churban? They paskin based on din Torah, says Abravanel, because sometimes you need to paskin not on pi din Torah. Of course, this is not for each and every citizen or individual. It's for the Sanhedrin. It's part of their mandate to know when they need to make an exception and issue a contingency ruling. And according to the Abravanel, it is this type of ruling which is being expressed and communicated by the Sifrei. For again, it says, do not depart, yuminu small, from what they say, yuminu small. And it's the phrase that even if they tell you that right is left and left is right, you need to listen to them. Says Abarbanel, if it's right, why are they saying that it's left? If it's left, why are they saying that it's right? And if so, why should you listen to them? The point is sometimes, even if the correct halachic ruling is right, the Sanhedrin may step in and say, but in this case, we need to go left. For broader concerns, for protection of the Jewish people and their relationship with Torah, and sometimes vice versa. And in those cases, the Torah says, you may think that it is right, that the ruling is right, that is to say, directionally right, and maybe you are correct, and still you need to follow them. And they also know, that's the, really the point of the Abravanel, this isn't a mistake. They also know that the ruling in principle is to the right, and still they say to the left, because the Sanhedrin needs to do that sometimes. So these are some of the major discussions that relate to the well-known statement of Yuminu Smol, as is found in the beginning of Shoftim. Moving on, I would say almost me'inyan inyan, but also inyan, a very related matter will bring us into the sugya of Novi, who was also discussed at length. We've met Novi actually in last week's parsha in Re'eh, which introduced, and then there's more in Parsha Shoftim. In Perek Yud Ches, Pasuk Tesvav, and let's have a look at the Pasuk, because, again, there's a well-known statement of Chazal, but we'll really get the the background if we see the Pesukim on location. Perek Yud Ches, Pasuk Tesvav, Navi Mikir Becha Me'achecha Kamoni. A Navi from amongst your midst, from your brothers, like me, this is Moshe Rabbeinu talking. Yakim lecha Hashem Elokecha, Hashem will raise up for you. Eilav tishma'un. Listen to him. Now, the question is, what is the meaning of these words, Eilav tishma'un? What is Moshe saying? Listen to him. Listen to him if he tells you to do what? Again, parenthetically, or we referenced it a few moments ago, a Navi, a prophet, as a Navi, has no halachic authority. As if to say, he cannot use his status as a prophet in order to push the halacha through, in order to issue a halachic ruling. Lo b'shamayim hi. It's an amazing situation, if you can imagine. I mean, it needs a certain temerity, it needs a certain constitution. But a Navi is not disqualified from serving on the Sanhedrin, but he just needs to be qualified as a member of the Sanhedrin. Which means if you could imagine a situation where you have a Sanhedrin of 71, and 36 of them are 35 of them are Nevi'im and 36 of them are not, and they're split in that way. So you look at the Navi side, and we say, we're sorry, you're in the minority. What a minority to be in! But they're still the minority, because halachically, it doesn't make a difference if you're a Navi. What then is the meaning of Eilav Tishma'un? You must heed the words of the Navi. In what respect? About what? And here we come to, again, another institution within halacha, which is known as hara'as sha'a. Hara'as sha'a means, again, an emergency ruling. But it's not a halachic ruling in terms of what the halacha should be, but rather what it should be in this case. Let's illustrate by example. If that sounds abstract, we'll get straight down to the example. The classic example of hara'as sha'a of a Navi is Eliyahu Behar. We're well familiar with the story of Eliyahu, his confrontation with the prophets of Baal, and they had the two altars, and which one the fire would come down. And there's one aspect that we perhaps overlook, one aspect of that story, and that is what Eliyahu did by offering a korban, technically, is an aveira. And the reason why is because, as the Torah states in last week's parsha, when the Beis HaMikdash, Mishkan, or Beis HaMikdash, is standing, there is a prohibition against offering a korban anywhere outside of the Beis HaMikdash. It is known as boma, a private altar. And this is not part of the celebrated aspect of the story, but essentially what Eliyahu did was he permitted a bomber. And how's he able to do that? I mean, that's an Isser Torah. Says the Gemara in Masechet Yevamos Daf Tzadik, that's called Hara'asha. Hara'asha, it was a ruling for the time, and he could do it because he's a Navi. And how do we know that a Navi can do something like that? What's the source in the Torah? Says the Gemara, the words Elav Tishma'un. When the Pasuk says Elav Tishma'un, listen to the Navi, it is referring to this type of situation. He cannot change the halacha on an ongoing basis. He cannot even paskin the halacha on an ongoing basis. Not by force of nevuah. He cannot say, I've received a prophetic vision that the halacha is like that for all time. But he can say that for this situation, as a Navi, there can be an override. We've mentioned in the past, when referring to the story, the classic observation of Rav Reuven Margolius in his Sefer Margolius Hayam on Sanhedrin. If you look, it's the Haftarah for Kisisa, the confrontation. Eliyahu and Aaron obviously mirroring Moshe with the Chetah Egel. Very often we don't get to read it because it's one of the four parshas of Shkolim or whatever, or Parah. But be that as it may, it's in Malachim Aleph, Perek Yudches, and it's described over the course of many psukim. And it describes that Eliyahu did this, and he did this, and he's mentioned many times. And at a certain point, as he just is about to engage in the confrontation and ask for fire to come down, it says, "Vayhi ba'alos ha-mincha," it was as the mincha time came, or the mincha, "Vayigash Eliyahu ha-Navi vayomer." He offers his prayer that Hashem should answer him. So Rav Reuven Margolius asked a simple shaila. I'm this deep into Perek Yudches. If I didn't know he's a Navi already, why am I being told now? The norm is introduce him. If he needs introduction, introduce him in Pasuk Aleph when you first mention him, and then from then on, it's based on the above. Here, for the whole time, it's been Eliyahu, and at this point, halfway through the Perek, he becomes Eliyahu HaNavi. Why does the Torah mention him that he is a Navi at this stage specifically? So Reuven Margolius says, because based on the Gemara, we understand. We know he's a Navi. But the Torah emphasizes that he's a Navi here because what he's about to do can only be done because he's a Navi. About to call for a fire to come down, and essentially a process of a korban outside the Beis HaMikdash. That's an Isser Torah. That's Boma. How can he do that? Because he's a Eliyahu HaNavi. Now, there are certain provisos with regard to the Torah. Obviously, from our point of view, don't try it at home. But the Gemara says, number one, he needs to be established as a Navi already. This can't be his debut. He needs to have a good record and good be known as a Navi. That's number one. Navi Muchzak, established as a Navi before this whole thing starts. Number two, says the Gemara, he needs just cause. I mean, it can't be an arbitrary thing. He can't come in and say, this is mutter. Why? Because it's mutter. He needs to be protecting somehow against a broader issue, what's called Lemigdar Milsa, to protect. And finally, and not surprisingly, says the Gemara, this can apply to many, many types of Torah prohibition, but there's no Dezara. No Navi can ever state that in this situation it's permitted to serve Avodah Zarah, even for the best reason in the world. You imagine such a reason would exist. Avodah Zarah is off limit. And those are the conditions and provisos. And what's fascinating, and just to get a window into how the Meshech Chochma learns the psukim, I mean, he looks. We have the same psukim printed as he does, but somehow he just seems to see more than we do. And whoever sold him his chumash, if he knew that at the time, would have charged him more, I think. But the pasuk says like this: Navi mikerbecha meachecha kamon, a navi from amongst you, from your brethren, like me. This is again Moshe talking. Yakim lecha Hashem Elokecha, Hashem will raise up for you Elav Tishmaon. Listen to him. And according to the Gemara, it means for a Hara'as Sha'a type of situation. Why should you listen to him? Here, the Pasuk is establishing not only that you should, but why you should. The reason why you should, says Moshe, is because I am telling you that any bona fide Navi is fundamentally Kamoni. He's like me. When we see Moshe talk about another Navi being like him, it should raise the alarm, because that's contradicted by the Torah. the Torah says there was never, never was, and never will be a Navi like Moshe. We say in Yigdal, lo kam Navi od b'Yisrael ka Moshe. So if there was never a Navi like Moshe, how can Moshe say that Hashem will appoint a Navi like me? It must be, says Meshech Chochma, that he isn't saying he'll be like me in terms of level. However, he will be like me in principle, in form, in name. He is a Navi, and all, and Navim, once he's in, it can make a difference. The way it can make a difference is that he can repeal on a contingency basis something that I have said. A love tishma'un. He can only do that because I'm a Navi and he's a Navi. He can't do it on a permanent basis because I'm a greater Navi than him. This is Moshe. But nonetheless, because I'm a Navi and he's also a Navi, kamoni, he can do so on a contingency basis. And therefore, says Meshech Chochma, that is what's behind the idea that there can be no Hara Shah for Avodah Zarah. Why not? Again, for us, we may think that doesn't require any explanation. But the explanation is, says Meshech Chochma, because if the basis of a later Navi issuing a Hara'as Shah is because Moshe is a Navi and he's a Navi, it can only be true for things that we heard through Nevuah of Moshe. But the prohibition against Avodah Zarah, we didn't get it through Moshe. We got it direct. We got it direct from Hashem. Anochi and Noyiyah Lacha Mipi Agavura Shema. We heard them directly. Something that we heard directly from Hashem, so no Navi can ever repeal that, even on a temporary basis. It is only everything beyond Avodah Zarah that a Navi can. And with this in mind, says Meshech Chochma, look at the next two or three psukim. The question he's about to raise is so elementary. I think the only reason we wouldn't raise it is because we wouldn't know what to do with it. But Pasuk Tet Zayin reads, Moshe is taking the Jewish people back to Matan Torah. And what did you say at the Har Sinai? I can't take it, said the Jewish people. We can't take hearing Hashem's voice. We'll expire. Hashem said, that's a good thing that they said. They're correct. And because they're correct, therefore what? If we would stop at this point, we would say, therefore, the following dibros, they'll hear from you. The ensuing dibros, they'll hear from you. But the next pasuk reads, Yudches, Navi akim lahem, mikere vachem kamocha. I'll set up appoint a Navi from their brethren. And the pasuk seems to have taken a turn that we weren't expecting. The result of the Jewish people not hearing Hashem is that they heard from Moshe. What's it got to do with pointing another Navi like Moshe after him? How's that relevant at all? It's past Sinai. Says Meshech Chochma, it makes a difference. Because if the Jewish people had not asked Moshe to intercede, but rather had proceeded to hear the entire Aseres Adibros, which include all of Torah from Hashem, then no Navi could ever have issued a Hara'as Shah, because he would be up against what they heard directly from Hashem. And therefore, part of the benefit, quote-unquote, of things shifting after the first two dibros from Hashem to Moshe is not only that they will now hear from Moshe, but it allows for the possibility that others, other Nevi'im, will have a certain leeway that they wouldn't have otherwise had, known as Hara'as Shah. Which means, if we put it all together, it's such an amazing way of looking at the psukim, although one wonders, is there another way, that the Jewish people in the time of Eliyahu, who were returned from good, from bad to good, who were returned from Baal back to Torah, they owed that episode to the Jewish people at the time of Har Sinai, asking Moshe to tell them the rest of the Aseres Adibros. Now, an interesting point to consider, again, in Hara'as Shah, although I'll mention something parenthetically, I saw it, it's from elsewhere in the Meshech Chochma, in the Haftarah Tiki Sisa. It's just the way that he looks at things, one couldn't anticipate. Because this really highlights how amazing the episode of Eliyahu at Har Carmel. He's in the north, right? Eliyahu and Elisha, they're in the north, they're not in the south. Yeah, that's why they're not near the Beit HaMikdash. And Eliyahu creates a revolution. He almost all of the kingdom of the north was straying after Avodah Zarah. Eliyahu brought them back. He did so through the Isser of Bama. There's Meshech Chochmah, you know, we don't always know exactly in terms of north and south how much each part of the land of Israel knew about what was going on. But one thing you can be sure is that Meshech Chochmah, this episode made waves. Back in the south, in Yehuda and in Binyamin, they heard about this. It's the single most important event when you think turning the tide of the entire northern kingdom against Avodah Zarah. They heard about it. And so something very interesting, says Meshech Chochmah. You know, when the Torah describes Malchi Yehuda past that point, again, Malchi Yehuda back in the south, very often we find that they're successful in eradicating Avodah Zarah, but there's one thing they can never really get rid of, and that's Bomos. It's almost like a refrain within the Psukim. Vayas Hayashav Be'enei Hashem, and he got rid of Avodah Zarah. Rak HaBomos Lo Isi. He never really succeeded in getting rid of Bomos. And the question is, why not? As if to say, if everyone's on board with everything, how come they drew the line at Bomos? So the Meshech Chochmah suggests, amazingly, it could be that people found it hard to see what was so wrong with Bomos, because the incredible event of Eliyahu at Har HaCarmel actually was a bomber. And look what happened. Save the Jewish people, and therefore they found it difficult to fully connect when they said, you know, Avodah Zarah is out and bombers are out as well. The bombers, Eliyahu did very well by his bomber. Maybe I could do well by mine as well. In any event, that's his suggestion there. What's interesting is Eliyahu Bahar HaKarmel, I think it's fair to say he's always the one that we think of when we discuss this idea of Hara Shah. If you ask her, give me an example of Hara Shah, the answer will tend to be Eliyahu Bahar HaKarmel. That's the Gemara's example. When the Gemara says Hara Shah like Eliyahu Bahar HaKarmel, it's Eliyahu, the one that we always talk about. Rambam also, as he codifies this, he mentions Eliyahu as the prototype almost of Hara Shah. Why? Well, presumably because it was the most high-profile case of Hara Shah. Perhaps we could say that it's the classic case of Hara Shah. If we would say that, then we would have missed a very interesting point, which is made again by Meshech Chochmah. The truth of the matter is, Eliyahu at Har HaCarmel is not your classic Hara Shah. It's not typical at all. It is atypical for the following reason. Again, if we describe in one sentence what is a Hara Shah, a Navi, an established Navi, can override or suspend even an Isser Torah on a contingency basis for just cause. And that's Hara Shah in a nutshell. What was the Isser Torah suspended by Eliyahu at Har HaCarmel? Bamos. Now, we know, however, that there's one exception to the rule. No Navi. Doesn't matter how muchzak he is, no Navi can ever override Avodah Zarah, can ever permit Avodah Zarah. But Eliyahu permitted Bomos. What's Bomos all about when the Torah forbids private altars? Do we know why? The Torah itself seems to say why. The first time we have the prohibition against Bomos, private altars, is in Parshas Acharei. And there the Torah says, if there's a Mishkan, you've got to bring it to the Mishkan. If there is a place, you've got to bring it there. Why? Says the Pasuk, Vayikra Perek Tzayin, because people shouldn't be, they will no longer offer their korbanos to Se'irim. Se'irim in this context are like demons. So the reason why bomos, private altars, are forbidden is because you don't want the Jewish people offering to demons, which is basically Avodah Zarah. But how does Eli to be? I mean, one could do anything privately or publicly. But the Pasuk seems to be expressing that that was really the concern, could lead to Avodah Zarah. Why? Because if everyone is just in their own private property, very difficult to regulate, very difficult to oversee, and very difficult to guide. And in fact, there's an amazing medrash in Vayikra Rabbah, which really elaborates on this point. It gives a mashal of a king whose son, he began to go all over the place here and there, was acting inappropriately, eating things he shouldn't be eating and doing things he shouldn't be doing. So the king says, what am I going to say to him? Act correctly? The the course of action here is that I'll ensure that he's always eating at my table. Because if he's eating at my table, he'll eat things he should be eating and hopefully act in the way he should be acting. If he's not at the table, so anything can happen. And that's the moshel of the Medrash with regard to bombers. Hashem says, you know, if they're not at my table, there's no saying what could happen. And the background here is the Jewish people having come out of Mitzrayim, where they were exposed to and involved in, to some degree, also in Avodah Zarah, which means if it's not somehow centralized or regulated, and each man for himself, anything could happen. And therefore, in the interest, it doesn't mean that every bomber, every offering for an Obama will automatically, by definition, be Avodah Zarah. It doesn't mean that. But there's a risk, there's a tendency, which may become more of a reality, that bombers are almost like a protection against Avodah Zarah. That's very interesting, because once we understand, and we've taken a few moments to really establish this idea, that the Torah prohibition of bomos is protection against Avodah Zarah, there might be room to think that perhaps bomos are also off limits for a Horas Shah. Did we not say that the one exception to the rule, a Navi can override temporarily many things, but not Avodah Zarah, perhaps also not things that are conducive to Avodah Zarah, or have to lead to the risk of Avodah Zarah, including bombers. That's what, and there, to this end, actually, by holding up the case of Eliyahu at Har HaKarmel, we see a certain chiddush. A Torah prohibition can be overridden by a Navi. Not Avodah Zarah, but other things, including bombers, because they're not out and out Avodah Zarah, even though they're maybe not too far away, or could lead to, but they themselves are not Avodah Zarah. That's a chiddush. It's not the normal case at all. That it gives us the frontier of Harasha. But then there is a follow-up, and that is, bombers are such a sensitive area, and they're again, were never more than a step away from Avodah Zarah, but Eliyahu could permit it. But the proviso is, he can only permit it if what he's protecting against is actual Avodah Zarah. As if to say, because there's an Avodah Zarah association with bomos, nothing would be considered just cause in permitting them as a broader concern other than avoiding actual Avodah Zarah itself, which is exactly what Eliyahu was doing. So it's such a fine situation. The Jewish people are involved in Baal worship. I mean, that is Avodah Zarah muvhak. And Eliyahu steps in and says, I'm going to allow them to do something which under normal circumstances is one step away from Avodah Zarah itself. But they're actually in Avodah Zarah. To protect against that, bombers is mutter. That is a very sensitive situation, a very delicate hurrah there for Eliyahu. And perhaps that's why Eliyahu is the one who's always chosen. Not because he represents the norm, he is far from the norm, but he represents the edge, how far hurrah Shah can go. Interestingly, and perhaps as a PS, it's worthwhile mentioning that there seems to be another case which answers to all of the description, the entire description that we've given to Eliyahu, which happened earlier on, perhaps a lower profile case. And that happened with Gidon, with the Shofet Gidon. What's Gidon famous for in our consciousness? He led the war against Midian, they took the earthenware vessels and the lights, and they cracked them, and they routed Midian. He's famous for the battle, rightly so. But prior to the battle, he offered a korban and shoked in Perig Vav. A malach appears to him and tells him to offer a korban, which he does. Now, once again, strictly speaking, don't forget, Gidon also lives at a time where bomos are off limits. There's no Beis HaMikdash yet, but there is a Mishkan. And because the Mishkan was there, there's a Torah prohibition against bomos. But he did it. And the reason why he did it is, once again, in order to promote, as the Ralbag explains, in order to promote feelings of emunah and dedication for HaKadosh Baruch Hu, they needed a korban. The people needed a korban. They were a bit all over the place. And therefore, this set their focus and their devotion and dedication to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, which was necessary in order for them to defeat Midian. When we think about it, what we have just described is a pre-episode of Eliyahu Bahar HaKarmel. It's exactly the same. Gideon is a Navi. He's addressed by a Malach. I mean, he received that divine message from a Malach. He is a Navi. As such, in keeping with that authority, he then permit something on a contingency basis, on a one-off basis, hara'ah shah, that otherwise is covered by din Torah. And the reason why he does so is in order to promote feelings of emunah, which were somewhat fragmented amongst the Jewish people. It's Eliyahu b'Har HaKarmel, except it's not that person, not that location, and none of the above. But the form is exactly the same, and the concerns are exactly the same. Interestingly, Gidon didn't get the label as much as it's he came before Eliyahu. But when we think of Hara'ah Shah, even with these chidushim, we go straight for Eliyahu, but not for Gidon. But now the question is, why not? Seemingly the same chidushim are in place. Well, the Maratz Chayas, who actually has a whole sefer dedicated to Nevuah, it's called Teras HaNevi'im, he explains that there is actually one chidush that we find in Eliyahu's case that does not exist in Gidon's case. And that is, who was it that brought the Korban? Who was it that was active? In Gidon's case, it was Gidon. I mean, it's just him. It's just him and the Malach. And the Malach's not doing anything. The Malach is instructing him, and he does. In Eliyahu's case, Eliyahu is the one that gave the instruction. And that is a major distinction. And the reason why is because it's one thing to say that if you're a Navi and a Malach appears to you and tells you to do something on a one-off basis, hara'ah shah, for just cause, even though it violates, okay, that's a certain situation. You are receiving that information directly from a Malach. And as the Rambam states in the Mor Nevuchim, one thing we need to know about Nevuah, and that is by the time a person is qualified to receive Nevuah, when they do receive Nevuah, there is no doubt in their mind as to what is happening. Which means that there is no room for doubt. And Gidon didn't think, maybe I'm just seeing things. So he has absolute authoritative information that what he is about to do is correct. Now that's still a chiddush, but it's a lesser chiddush. Because when it comes to Eliyahu, so how does Eliyahu know? Because he's the Navi. But who actually builds the Mizbechos and who offers all of these animals, etc.? It's the people. But based on what? On Eliyahu. But they didn't hear a Nevuah. All they heard was a Navi. And therefore, we understand why, even though the situations of Gidon and Eliyahu are so similar, but in this respect, they're absolutely different. Because for Gidon to act on instructions that he himself received as a Navi is one thing. For the people in Eliyahu's time to act on instructions that they received from a Navi, that's all they have to go on. That's a lav tishmoa. That's the Torah saying, listen to the Navi. You have no idea what he heard, but you know he's a Navi, and you know what he's saying, a lav tishmoa. And that's how Eliyahu Bar HaKarmel becomes the case that is always referred to for Harasha. Well, we've had some weighty discussions this evening. What happens when you give the rabbi a vacation. But I'd like to perhaps conclude with a really wonderful comment which relates to the very end of the Parsha. The end of Parsha Shoftim is the section of Egla Rufa. And Egla Rufa, as we know, it's got its own very enigmatic point, but it begins with the person he's found, Kimatzei Halal, he's been killed, no one knows what happened, he's outside the city limits, and we don't know what happened. But someone killed him. And they have the whole procedure, and it is a procedure. And the Sanhedrin comes out, and everyone makes their declarations, and they bring this Egla Rufa, which is its own type of shocking thing, and they decapitate it from behind, and everyone's like, what a thing to do, but that pales in comparison with what happens to this person. Someone did that to this person. No one saw. And people absolve themselves of responsibility, which they should be in a position to do. We weren't neglectful of him, we didn't, etc. and so forth. It's a whole event. Now what's interesting is the subject which has been discussed just before Egla Rufa, the penultimate subject of Shoftim, is war. Ki teitzei lemelchama levecha, many of the well-known halachas of war are discussed there in that earlier section, just before the end of Shoftim, that the Mashuach Mohammed, that Kohen, should go out and send certain people home, whoever's down to the vineyard, who's ever just been engaged, who's ever is afraid, who's ever, that whole thing, that's all in Shoftim. That's all, that's war has begun to be discussed in Shoftim. How to lay siege? So it's interesting because the parak, the previous parak begins ki tetzela melchama levecha. We're more familiar with, if you hear the words ki tetzela melchama levecha, and someone says, "Where's that from?" Well, then we know it's from Parshas Ki Tzeitzeh, which starts ki tetzela melchama levecha. But it happens to be that the Torah mentions ki tetzela melchama alevecha twice. Once at the end of Shoftim, which didn't become its own new parsha, and then once at the beginning of Ki Tzeitzeh. That being the case, so we're in a very interesting situation, because in between these two discussions of war is the discussion of something that actually doesn't has nothing to do with war. Because the situation of Eglah Rufa, it's completely unrelated to war. It could happen at any time. And it's a very interesting shaila, and it's a question again that we might read the parshas many times, but never really ask this question. The Torah seems to have interrupted its discussion of war to talk about something that's unrelated, known as Eglah Rufa. What is behind the Seder here? Because basically it's war, Eglah Rufa, more war. And this question is discussed by one of the great Darshanim of the last century, of Rebbe Yaakov Yosef of Vilna, who later then came to New York, and the ill-fated venture of becoming its chief rabbi. He became known to others as Rabbi Jacob Joseph. His better years were in Vilna, not in New York. And he was a great darshan, and the Gedolim of Vilna used to come to his drushes. Of Chaim Moshe Gurchinsky used to come to his drushes. I mean, that's good. And he says a fascinating thing. War, as we know, and we shouldn't know from these things, but we know that when people are involved in war, and if need be, they're prepared to take the enemy's life, and it's for a good cause, etc. But it can leave a person callous. It can desensitize a person. The type of person that during peacetime would never hurt a fly, all of a sudden he's called upon to do things, and he needs to do them. But there can be fallout. There can be follow-up. And that is either respect for or sensitivity towards human life, even of his own, it goes down. It can be. And that really is what the Torah is protesting and refusing to allow to happen here. As if to say, consider, at a time of war, things are done that otherwise would never be done. At a time of peace, or for a nation that's never known war, if one person is, lo aleinu, found to be killed outside the city, people never heard, they've never seen someone who's been killed, or it's an uproar, and it's a whole trauma, and rightly so. But what if those two go together? As if to say, what if the people, they've been at war, I mean, they're battle-hardened. And then the war is over. But there's another war that's going to be coming soon. And in the meanwhile, they come home and someone's been killed. There is perhaps a tendency, wrong though it is, that there may be less of a sensitivity to it. As if to say, they've seen people die. They may have discharged their duty themselves. And now another person died, and that's life. And therefore, the Torah here is expressing the high standards that demands of the Jewish people. As if to say, if you fight the enemies of the Jewish people and do what needs to be done, which may even involve taking life, and perhaps they may take life from the side of the Jewish people, that doesn't mean that the sensitivity to the life of every individual Jew should in any way be affected by that. It may naturally be, fight against it, make a point of it, because that's an unacceptable lapse. And therefore it's specifically sandwiched, so to speak, between discussions of war, because the Jewish people may find themselves between wars or whatever, and at the time. But if this happens, the outrage and the upset should be no different than if they'd ever seen war before. And the Sanhedrin comes out, and everyone is on edge, because it's a terrible thing, and it remains a terrible thing. That doesn't go away just because other terrible things have happened. So it's an amazing way to end the parsha, in a sense, because there's many national things which are being described, and war is a national thing. But there is such a thing called the value of life of the individual Jew, and that shouldn't get somehow lost or swallowed up, or as as all the broader discussions, the broader concerns are brought into play. We'll leave it over there for this evening. Pick up again with the show next week.